When you lock a secret in a vault, you know, you generally expect it to stay there.
Right, you think it's buried for good.
Exactly. You swallow the key, you assume you have total control over the narrative, and you just get on with your life.
Yeah, that's the hope anyway.
But when you step into the world of Murari, and specifically the events laid out in Log P24, you realize that secrets aren't static.
No, not at all.
They are these living, volatile entities that actively rewrite the reality around them.
Which is terrifying if you're the one trying to keep the secret.
Truly. So, welcome to today's deep dive. Today, we are unpacking a timeline where a glowing ivory cup forces a deep cover spy to unmask himself.
Yeah, that scene is incredible.
And we're also going to look at how you can find a miraculously surviving princess just by, like, looking really closely at a little girl holding a unicorn doll.
It really forces us to examine the anatomy of a lie. You know,
yeah.
What Log P24 does so brilliantly is contrast things.
Contrast in what way?
Well, you have these sprawling, cross-dimensional political conspiracies of Murari. But then they are juxtaposed against these incredibly claustrophobic, intimate moments of forced authenticity.
Right. Sweeping institutional deception versus basically a conversation between two people in a freezing room.
Exactly.
Which brings us right to Hawksmoor Keep. Since you are already following the lore, you know the stakes here. Hannah has just led her friends through the Golden Woods.
And those woods are currently choked by the Dark Witch's illusions.
Yeah, which are completely lethal. And Nathaniel's reaction is exactly what we'd expect from a veteran Golden Hawk, right? He demands an army.
I mean, it's a logical response.
It is. Because if Nathaniel knows the illusions have physical heat-like, a phantom dragon's breath can actually leave third-degree burns. His demand for a military force isn't just skepticism.
Right. It's tactical triage. He's assessing the threat.
So the big question for you is, why on earth does Tom think sneaking in with a cup beats a weaponized thermal illusion?
Because Tom understands the mechanical nature of the Dark Witch's magic way better than the veterans do.
Okay, break that down for us.
Well, Nathaniel is treating the illusions as physical obstacles, right? Like walls to be broken or enemies to be destroyed by force.
But they aren't physical.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Tom recognizes them as conceptual lies. If an illusion is fundamentally a lie made manifest, you don't fight it with swords.
Oh, that makes so much sense.
You introduce the physical antimatter to a lie, which in this world is absolute truth.
Mm-hmm.
So he proposes this two-man stealth night raid using a specific holy artifact.
And that leads Tom and his friend Simon deep into Hawksmoor's depleted dry goods storeroom, which, by the way, is just a brilliant setting.
It's so gritty and real.
Yeah. They're literally digging through crates of rotting arrows and moth-eaten blankets in the freezing dark, just trying to find a literal holy relic.
And the physical excavation of that room triggers a massive emotional excavation for Simon.
It really does. The sheer crushing weight of what they are about to unearth causes Simon to just completely break down.
He just falls apart.
He confesses that his entire identity is a complete fabrication.
Yeah, he strips away the Simon persona completely right there in the dark. He reveals he is actually Sir LaFallon.
A Fey Knight.
Exactly. A Fey Knight operating on direct orders from the highly influential Lord April.
And the mechanics of this espionage, they are just brutal.
Oh, absolutely ruthless.
Like, Lord April didn't just send a scout to look around. He used a scrying glass to locate a specific marginalized, bullied mortal boy.
Yeah, he targeted someone vulnerable.
And LaFallon was sent to take that boy's place, to study his life, and this is the crazy part, literally absorb the physical beatings that boy would have received.
Just to maintain the cover.
All to act as a sleeper agent, monitoring these mortals for any connection to Murari's missing king. Okay, let's unpack this.
It's a lot to process.
Imagine finding out the person who has been your closest confidant, the person you've, like, bled with, was fundamentally designed to be your warden.
It would be complete psychological devastation.
But LaFallon admits his loyalty genuinely shifted. He says it's because Tom offered him actual friendship instead of treating him as a tool.
Which is a huge turning point.
Right. But how do we reconcile a bond that is structurally built on a lie, even if the current emotional output is real?
What's fascinating here is how the artifact itself answers that question.
The Grail.
Yeah. They are in that room to find the Holy Grail. And we aren't talking about, like, a jewel-encrusted goblet from the movies.
Right. The text is very specific about how it looks.
It's just a simple ivory ceramic cup resting in a wooden box.
Mm.
But it emits this daylight bright glow that physically banishes shadows.
It represents absolute, unyielding truth.
Exactly. And the magical physics of Mirari dictate that you simply cannot unearth an artifact of absolute truth while your own internal foundation is built on a dark, active lie.
So the cup forced his hand.
Yes. The Grail's proximity acts as a metaphysical pressure cooker. It forces Lafond's confession because the artifact simply demands total authenticity.
And Tom's reaction is what completely subverts the expected betrayal arc here.
He handles it so differently than you'd expect.
Right. He doesn't draw his weapon. He doesn't scream at him. He just, he forgives LaFallon on the spot.
He basically states that choosing to be a friend when you were literally programmed to be a spy is the highest form of loyalty.
But Tom choosing to accept LaFallon's unmasking triggers a massive unmasking of his own.
Oh, yeah. The domino effect is immediate.
Because the moment they carry that glowing grail out to the courtyard, Nathaniel resumes his interrogation. He's like, what authority do you have to lead a suicide mission?
And Tom just casually dismantles Nathaniel's entire chain of command.
It's such a power move.
He looks at this veteran Goldenhawk and states that if he were still in the ranks, he would outrank him. Tom reveals himself to be the legendary Lord Explorer.
The guy who vanished into the mortal realm 15 years prior.
Exactly. Which completely shatters Nathaniel's perception of reality.
Well, yeah, because Tom looks like a young man in his 20s.
The math just doesn't work.
Right. If he's the Lord Explorer who vanished 15 years ago, Nathaniel thinks he should be a doddering old man by now.
But Tom drops the detail that he was only about 6 years old when he left Mirari.
Which pushes us straight into the logistical nightmare of Mirari's timeline.
It is a total headache.
Yeah.
In the best way.
As Tom and Simon are gathering lanterns for the raid, they get into this deeply philosophical debate. Tom starts piecing together his fragmented, dreamlike memories.
The stuff he can barely remember.
Yeah. He recalls negotiating with a dangerous bandit queen 19 years ago to save his followers.
And he remembers crossing paths with the sorceress Nimue.
But the timeline simply does not compute if you apply mortal physics.
No, not at all.
Yeah.
A man in his 20s cannot have brokered a treaty 19 years ago if he only left the realm 15 years ago at age 6.
So Tom is forced to posit this crazy paradigm-shifting hypothesis. He thinks time in Mirari does not function as a straight line.
Right. It operates as overlapping realities or like loops.
When they were having their past adventures in the mortal realm, they were actually bleeding over into Mirari's distant past.
Which is mind-bending.
Here's where it gets really interesting. If time is a series of overlapping realities, it perfectly explains why the Grail was positioned in that dusty storeroom.
Oh, because they already put it there.
Yes. They had already lived the past adventures that planted the artifact there for them to find in the present.
It's a closed loop.
But let's look at the psychological toll of that. It's like debugging a loop in complex software code.
That's a great way to put it.
If Tom knows a catastrophic failure trapped him in the mortal realm 14 years ago, and he is now living a temporal do-over, does that knowledge liberate him or completely paralyze him?
It's a heavy burden.
Because if he goes back to fix the bug that trapped him, does he inadvertently compile an entirely different present where he and Simon never even meet?
And Simon's mind essentially shorts out trying to process that exact paradox.
I mean, who's what?
Exactly. The fear of erasing their own current existence by altering the past is totally paralyzing for Simon.
But Tom handles it differently.
Yeah. Tom's philosophical framework rejects that paralysis. He delivers this crucial piece of dialogue. He says, not knowing is no reason to not do something.
Wow.
He acknowledges all the terrifying what-ifs of a non-linear timeline, but he just refuses to surrender his agency to them.
He strips all the romanticism right out of the hero's journey, right there in the armory.
He really does.
He tells Simon that eventually, balladeers will write these grand, sweeping songs about them carrying the Grail into the dark woods.
But those songs are going to omit the reality.
Exactly. They'll completely omit the freezing cold, the sheer exhaustion, and the absolute gut-wrenching terror they are experiencing right now.
He places the emphasis entirely on human agency over some preordained destiny.
True weakness isn't feeling fear in a non-linear universe.
Right.
It's letting that fear stop you from walking into the woods.
And that decision to walk into the darkness with the light of truth, it serves as a perfect thematic bridge for the log.
Because it's happening everywhere.
Yes. Tom's personal assertion of agency and his unmasking in Hawksmoor is basically a microcosm of a much larger institutional unmasking happening simultaneously across the whole realm.
Right as Tom prepares for his night raid, the atmospheric magic of Mirari shifts entirely. Over at House October, our other protagonists, Agatha and Alice, witness a true dawn.
And we have to remember, in Merari, weather isn't just meteorological.
It's deeply tied to the realm's moral and political state.
Exactly. This long, oppressive winter they've been having is a physical manifestation of the realm's decay.
So a true dawn is a big deal.
It's huge. It's a brilliant golden sunrise that actively, physically pushes back the magical shadows.
It illuminates everything that the darkness has been trying to conceal.
And the setting for this illumination is Lord October's parlor, which, by the way, is a masterpiece of environmental storytelling.
Oh, it's so cool. Describe it for us.
Well, Agatha and Alice are brought in for a morning meeting, but they aren't in some stuffy stone room.
Yeah.
The parlor is literally an indoor autumn glen.
Like, inside the house.
Yes. The ceiling is woven from vibrant leaf trees, the chairs are carved from boulders, and there is a functional waterfall bubbling through a mossy channel right in the floor.
It sounds beautiful.
It is ancient elemental magic. And in this room, they sit with Lord October and his antlered handmaiden, Lady Iseult, to investigate the realm's missing historical figures.
They start with the Lord Protector Melchizedek. Lady Iseult is trying to piece together his final movements based on these wild rumors.
Rumors that he headed west toward Icejaw Pit.
Which is a notoriously hostile region, right? Swarming with dragons and those malevolent creatures known as Drew.
Yeah, you don't go there for a vacation.
And her only connective tissue is this obscure story about a bandit who is cured of a strange madness by a unicorn horn, which theoretically places Melchizedek in that region.
It's a massive leap of logic.
It really is. Then they pivot to an even older mystery. The disappearance of Lord Bram and Lady Angelique.
The ancient founders of houses April and October.
Lady Iseult recites this myth that they vanish fighting a dragon in the north.
And notice the methodology of the Merari adults here.
It's so flawed.
They are relying entirely on third-hand rumors, wildlander myths, and the dusty chronicles of the Golden Hawks.
They don't have any hard facts.
No. In a closed system like Merari, which has been isolated for centuries, written myth completely replaces empirical science.
And Agatha just completely shatters that methodology.
She doesn't even hesitate.
She casually leans forward and reveals that she and Alice actually possess tangible, cross-dimensional proof of Bram and Angelique's fate.
Physical evidence.
Yes. They found actual letters written by Lord Bram, physically hidden inside Lady Angelique's hand mirror.
Which they found buried deep in an underground mine back in the mortal world of Ainnicton.
The contrast is staggering. You have these ancient, incredibly powerful beings who are completely blind to the truth because they are drowning in their own mythology.
While two mortal kids are effortlessly solving centuries-old mysteries.
Simply because they hold empirical evidence.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, it perfectly illustrates the heavy burden of myth in closed ecosystems.
Oh, so?
Well, the adults in Merari unconsciously weaponize the absence of these figures to maintain their political stability.
Oh, I see.
Treating Bram and Angelique as untouchable legends ensures the foundation of their society is never questioned.
But Agatha and Alice are outsiders.
Exactly. They aren't burdened by the cultural reverence of Merari.
To them, the hand mirror isn't a holy relic.
It's just a mirror with letters inside. They destroy the institutional blindness simply by observing the facts.
Which perfectly primes that autumn glen for the most explosive, destabilizing truth of the entire log.
Oh, this part gave me chills.
Because once you prove that ancient myths can be unraveled by a girl with a mirror, you open the door to unraveling recent history.
The conversation naturally bleeds into the grim history of the Umbric dynasty.
A tragedy that effectively broke the constitutional balance of the realm. Let's go over the timeline Lord October recounts for the girls.
Okay, so King Mark of Umbrecht married Lady Seraph, who hailed from House April.
And they had a son, Prince Richard, who was the undisputed heir.
But during his very first jousting match, Prince Richard went up against a mysterious, blonde, black knight.
And during the bout, the knight's lance miraculously found a fatal, microscopic flaw in the prince's armor, killing him instantly.
It's just devastating.
And the tragedy compounded immediately. The queen was pregnant and delivered a newborn daughter, Princess Angel, shortly after her brother's death.
But the official narrative claims the baby died less than a day later.
But Lord October adds a massive red flag to this narrative. He says he personally interviewed the midwife.
And she swore on her life that the baby was perfectly healthy at birth.
The political fallout from this double tragedy is catastrophic.
Because the king believes his bloodline is entirely extinguished.
So King Mark names the Lord of April, his wife's brother, as his official successor.
We really need to understand the mechanics of why this matters so much.
Break it down for us.
Merari stability relies on a very delicate balance of power between these ancient houses.
Right.
By handing the throne to House April, the king completely violates a centuries-old pact between houses April and October.
He's consolidating too much authority.
Exactly. He's essentially setting the stage for a tyrannical monopoly on power.
And while Lord October is outlining this massive geopolitical crisis, Alice is undergoing a very quiet, very personal crisis of her own.
She's just sitting there listening to all this.
Yeah, clutching this red-maned unicorn doll she brought from the mortal realm.
And then she speaks up.
She interrupts this ancient lord and states that her doll's name is Lord Mel.
A nod to the Lord Protector, Melchizedek.
And then she reveals a detail that she previously thought was just like a sweet childhood memory.
The note.
Yeah. Her father gave her that doll with a note on fancy paper that read, "From your father, a faithful protector, always."
And the empirical evidence just clicks into place in Lord October's mind.
The timing, the physical age of the girl, the specific phrasing of a faithful protector, and the unicorn motif.
The ancient, powerful Lord October literally drops to one knee on his mossy floor.
Because Alice isn't just a random kid from Anakton who stumbled through a portal. She is the lost princess angel of Umbrecht.
It's an incredible reveal.
Her parents realized the death of her brother wasn't an accident, right? It was an assassination.
So to protect her from the exact same fate, they faked her death and smuggled her out of the dimension entirely.
So what does this all mean? We are looking at the most extreme cross-dimensional witness protection program imaginable.
They did such a good job hiding her.
They didn't just hide Alice in a different universe. They hid her identity from herself. She had no idea she was a royal refugee. She just thought she was Alice.
It forces us to completely reevaluate the overarching conspiracy.
How so?
Just look at the narrative architecture linking both locations.
Okay.
In Hawksmoor, Tom was hidden in the mortal realm.
Right.
In House October, Alice was hidden in the mortal realm.
Yeah.
But the most damning connection is the political reality of House April.
The house that stands to inherit the throne.
Yes. The exact same house that sent Sir Lefalon to secretly monitor Tom and the mortals is the exact same house that inherits absolute rule now that Alice's brother is dead and she was presumed lost.
The implications of that are terrifying. Lord April isn't just aggressively gathering intelligence.
No, he has a massive vested interest in making sure the true heirs to the throne never return from the mortal realm.
Because if Alice reclaims her title, House April loses the kingdom.
The personal unmasking of a spy in a freezing storeroom is directly tied to the geopolitical fate of the entire dimension.
Everything is connected. The isolation of the mortal realm was literally the only thing keeping the Umbrecht dynasty alive.
And now that the quarantine has been breached, the assassins of House April know exactly where to look.
Wow. We've tracked a massive somatic journey today.
We really have.
We started with two men digging through crates in the dark, where the absolute light of a glowing artifact forced a Fae Knight and a Lord Explorer to abandon their fabricated identities.
And we ended in a sunlit, magically constructed glen,
where the empirical evidence of a child's toy dismantled a kingdom's foundational myth, revealing a little girl to be the hidden savior of a royal dynasty.
It clearly demonstrates that truth is a physical force in Merari.
It really is. No matter how deeply it is buried under institutional lies or how chronologically twisted it becomes across different dimensions,
it always exerts pressure until it breaks the surface.
The logs remind us that maintaining a false reality requires a constant, exhausting expenditure of energy.
The truth eventually simply relies on gravity.
It makes you look at your own context a bit differently, you know?
Well, for sure.
As you navigate your own routines, consider how much of your personal narrative is shaped entirely by the boundaries of the system you are placed in.
It's a scary thought.
If you were suddenly handed the grail of your own history, if a single piece of undeniable evidence illuminated the fact that the foundational stories you've been told about yourself were constructed by someone else, how would you handle the unmasking?
Accepting that the parameters of your life were designed by an outside force requires a radical dismantling of the ego.
Are you the architect of your reality or just a resident in a carefully curated autumn glen?
It is definitely much easier to just keep believing in the dragon in the north.
It is. And speaking of dismantling realities, I want to leave you with a final mechanical puzzle to chew on before we go.
Okay, let's hear it.
We know Alice was exiled to the mortal realm to escape the fate of her brother, Prince Richard.
Right.
We also know Prince Richard's death was orchestrated by a mysterious blonde black knight from the Western lands, whose lance miraculously found a microscopic flaw in the prince's armor.
A very convenient flaw.
Exactly. But let's apply Tom's theory of Murari's timeline to this assassination.
Oh, the time loops.
Yes. If time is truly nonlinear, operating in overlapping loops where people can bleed into the past.
Oh my God.
Could that blonde black knight who killed the prince have been someone we've already tracked in these logs?
That would change everything.
What if the assassination wasn't just a contemporary political coup, but a strike carried out by someone sent backward through the timeline, specifically weaponizing nonlinear physics to deliberately alter the royal succession before it could even begin?
If the physics of time travel are actively being used for dynastic assassination, then finding the Holy Grail isn't the end of the mission.
No, it isn't.
It is barely the beginning.
We'll let you debug that temporal loop on your own.
Hmm?
Thanks for joining us for this deep dive into Log P24. See you next time.